All right, in our interim, in between getting into a weekly study, I'm teaching a few freestanding lessons, and you know, Paul and I go and speak quite a bit. And this past week, I was in Tulsa. I spoke at City Elders, which is a large Christian ministry that has a gathering on Thursdays. They're really doing a great job. And then I spoke Thursday night. I taught two sessions at the Liberty Center, where they not only have an audience, but they video all of these lessons, and they're building a video library of teachings on critical topics. And all three presentations were different, so I didn't share the same thing three times. So I had to prep for three different presentations. And I just thought that you guys might be interested to see some of the things that Paul and I share when we are traveling and speaking. And so I was asked for Thursday morning to talk about the Constitution, which honestly is not really my forte. My forte is the Declaration of Independence, and you'll see in just a moment why. But what they wanted me to do is to teach some of the essential parts of the U.S. Constitution, but the Christian motivation and influence behind it. And so I did that, and I'd never done this presentation before. Obviously, as you go through our history, you come across common things that you've seen or heard in other presentations. But I thought you might enjoy this morning to go through the presentation that I did at City Elders, so you can kind of see what we're out there sharing when we're going around, and why we both, meaning Paul and myself, feel like it's so important that we do that. It's not that we're just wanting to go and speak, because quite frankly, it's very hard on you. It wears on you quite a bit. Because I went up there late Wednesday night and then came back home and got home about midnight on Thursday night. So, and I'm not whining or complaining. It's just when you travel and go and speak, it's hard, plus all the other things that you're doing. And then I spent a couple of days putting together these new presentations, because it takes a lot of research. Because one of the things that we're both committed to doing is to documenting everything we share. We don't share anecdotes. We don't share what are called spurious quotes, where they're not documented. And you know, the Christian world, by the way, is very guilty of taking stuff off the internet and using it and teaching it as fact, when the fact is many times it's not fact. There are many quotes that are out there on the internet that are attributed to certain founders like Thomas Jefferson or whoever that they didn't actually say. And so it's very important to go back to as close to original documents as you possibly can, to original source documents, to get the documented information. So, by the way, be very careful when you get what you think is just too good of a quote not to share, and then you share it, and many times those quotes are just not true. The thought may be true, but the person that was supposedly the one who said it, or the actual quote, didn't ever even happen. Give you a good example. Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. That has been attributed to Thomas Jefferson for decades. He never said that. Now, he said things that were similar, but he never said that. That was actually a French orator by the name of Curran who said that. Thomas Jefferson didn't say that. So it's very important, because here's what happens. If we get our quotes wrong and we misattribute, people say, well, see, they don't even do their homework. So then when you do have something that's solid, they won't believe you. And that's why it's so important in our theology that we have it down solid, so that people can't say, well, they were completely wrong on that. I'll bet they're completely wrong on this. Now, we all make mistakes. And over the years, I have. Sometimes I've made the mistake of biting on something that I thought somebody had done their research on. Turns out, not so much. So anymore, I don't hardly trust anybody. whatever quote they put out there, I do my due diligence to try to trace that quote back as far as I can. Now, understand that there were not historians as we know them today during our founding era. There just weren't. There weren't the university. We had universities, but they weren't like they are now, and we didn't have credentials for historians. There were historians in that they kept records, they wrote these things down. So sometimes you finally get to the point where you have to trust someone who was there, who's actually quoting the other person, and it was never in writing. But if you can get to that point, you're on pretty solid ground. So I want you to go through this presentation with me today. I don't know how far we will get. It may take us a couple of weeks. Some of these things you've heard before. Some of them you may not have heard or heard in this particular fashion. And I hope that you enjoy it. And then if you do and you want me to, I'll teach the two sessions that I did on the most critical of all of our founding documents, which is the Declaration of Independence. We can go through that next, if you want to. It may be too much of a review for you for other things that you've done over the years. But I think there's some good stuff here that we need to, if not learn for the first time, certainly reinforce for the second or third time. So anyway, let's get started. The first thing that your outline emphasizes is that self-governance is historically extremely rare and fragile. Most people have not had the opportunity to live like we have. Most people in history have lived under some type of monarchy or dictatorship or totalitarian government of some sort. In fact, most people today alive on the planet are living under some type of monarchy. Typically today, it's a dictatorship or some type of totalitarian government. Very few people in history have been privileged to live under a self-governing type of or form of government. We are among those select few. And that's why it is so important. Now, Bill Federer, our friend, and I mean literally our friend, I know Bill very well. Paul does too. He's been here a number of times. Great guy, walking encyclopedia. He wrote a book not long ago. He shared some of it when he was here a few weeks ago, entitled From Change to Chains. But the subtitle is really more telling, The 6,000-Year Quest for Control. In that book, what he does is he traces the historical fact, which is the next point on your outline, power always seeks to consolidate itself to dominate others. Power is always seeking to consolidate. That is because mankind is a fallen creature. Now, our framers understood that. And because they understood that, they rejected the idea of creating a democracy. One of the things that many of you probably know, but some of you may not have trained yourself yet, do not call our form of governance a democracy. It is not a democracy. We use the democratic principle, but it is not a democracy. If you remember, a democracy is barely 50%, just over 50%, so a small majority can steamroll a very large minority that may be just slightly under 50%. Well, there's nothing fair about that. But you'll hear talking heads and professors and then innocent Christians talk about their democracy. We do not have a democracy. I have no desire to help establish democracies around the world. We are a republic. Now, that's not particularly the subject of this presentation or this lesson, but it's very important that we understand that, because in a democracy, power will try to consolidate so that they can have that very small majority to steamroll. Now, let me give you an example of how brutal democracy can be. How many of you believe that Charlie Meadows, before we leave here today, should give each one of us a $100 bill? How many of you would vote for that? All right. Now, how many would be against that? Only one. There's two. So it was almost unanimous. So there's two other crazy, insane people over here. That was almost unanimous, but it was definitely a majority. So Charlie, you owe each one of us $100. Guys, that's a democracy. Now, we laugh at that, But you know, that's how democracy works. And so you can force very bad and wicked things on people if you have a simple majority. It doesn't take but just a simple majority. That is why the framers placed certain checks and balances like two-thirds, three-fourths into our governing documents, because they didn't want a small majority steamrolling a large minority. It's very, very important. So remember then that power is always trying to consolidate itself. Now, what you see here on the screen is a very rare moment in human history. On December the 23rd, 1783, General George Washington was in charge of the most powerful military on the North American continent. He had just defeated what had been the most powerful military in the world, the British Army. He is now sitting at the pinnacle of military power. There were people in the colonies that are about to become states who were clamoring that they just declare George Washington King of America. Now, I'm sure had they, he would have been a very benevolent king. I have no doubt about that. But he refused that. In fact, he wouldn't even allow them, once he became the president, to be called Your Excellency. They were trying to come up with a title. And he said, how about just Mr. President? How about that? But on this particular occasion, it's very significant because he is voluntarily surrendering the army back to the Continental Congress on December the 23rd, 1783. Now, that is a very rare moment. In history, when most typically men, because they tend to be the ones who are the military leaders, most men who've ever had control of an army like that used that army to seize control. He did not. Now, that doesn't mean that George Washington was a perfect person, but I'll tell you, this does give you a window into his character, because this was a prime opportunity for him to elevate himself. Now, this is what I mean when I say that self-governance is very rare. That moment captured in that painting is a very rare moment in human history. In fact, so rare that I don't think most of us understand. See, we live through the majority of the history of man before the Magna Carta was forced on King John in 1215 AD. Now, there's another point on your outline that you need to capture a few points here if you don't know them by heart. Remember that the aristocracy, which would have been the landowners of that day, forced King John to sign the Magna Carta, which was the first real document other than the laws of Israel. Now, we have to accept Israel, but all other non-Jewish people, this is the first example in history where a monarch was forced to recognize basic individual rights and to begin to deal with the people, not necessarily as equals yet, but we're headed that way. This was an amazing moment. This is why when you go to the National Archives, there's a copy of the Magna Carta there. The reason why is because that was the beginning that leads us to the Declaration of Independence, which, as you already know, I believe is our most critical founding document. So the Magna Carta is an important moment because that's when man and his ability to rule begins to rise above all of the monarchs and dictators that he had known for centuries. So that is a sterling moment in the history of man. King John didn't want to do it. He was forced into it because monarchs typically do not relinquish power willingly. Dictators are even less willing because generally they rule with the military. At least with monarchs, they typically are hereditary, and many of them do tend to be slightly benevolent. Dictators, no. They typically get their position by military force, and they're not going to give it up. So that's the beginning. Now, of course, the Magna Carta ultimately leads to this document, the Declaration of Independence, which is our birth certificate. And I don't want to get too much into it, because if you choose that I teach those other two presentations about the Declaration, we'll go into it in depth. But it's very important that we catch the fact that it's in the Declaration that you find all of the key principles that are used to create the Constitution. Now, here's the way I like to define the Constitution. Here's God's Word. It's called the Bible, right? The B-I-B-L-E. Now, most churches also have a church constitution. I don't know of a church that doesn't. And the church constitution is a document that lays down who that church is and how it's going to function, how it's going to govern itself, who owns the property. You know, how is a pastor called? How is a pastor run off? And that's an important thing for you guys when you're thinking about Paul, how you run off. He'd laugh if he was here, I guarantee you. So that's the Constitution. But have you ever heard one time on a Sunday morning the preacher get up and say, open your constitutions to page 23 and let's look at section 2, paragraph 4? No, not unless it's a business meeting. Because preachers don't preach from the church constitution. Now, the church constitutions typically are written with biblical principles in mind, aren't they? I mean, if you want your constitution to be biblical, but you don't preach or teach from the church constitution, you preach from this. Now, why is that? Because the constitution is just a governing document. This is where all the principles are. Now, that is my belief about the Declaration of Independence. Now, it's not the Bible. Don't misunderstand. I don't believe it's a divinely inspired document. But when it comes to our founding documents, it's the principal document. It has all the principles in it. The Constitution is a way in which you govern according to those principles. We'll come back to that a little bit later. So then, there are people who make it a lifetime pursuit to try to force us to believe that the Constitution that derives itself from the Declaration, it comes out of the Declaration, is a godless document. So much so that these two Cornell professors, Isaac Kramnick, who's on the left there, by the way, sadly passed away last year, and Lawrence Moore spent basically a lifetime of trying to prove that the Constitution, and I don't know how much they said about the Declaration, but our founding was simply not Christian and without God. So much so that one of their most popular books written in 2005 was the book entitled The Godless Constitution. And in the book, they go to great lengths to say, well, the Constitution doesn't stress God and all that. Well, it doesn't. That is correct. I mean, they ended in the year of our Lord and all that, and there's some significance there. But in essence, they are right if you're just looking at the Constitution. But if you understand that the Constitution comes from the Declaration, and you know what the Declaration says, then all of a sudden you don't have a godless Constitution. That's very important. Now, in 2018, they wrote this book, Godless Citizens in a Godly Republic, where once again they're criticizing our form of governance, and they say, you know, we're persecuting these godless individuals by forcing Christianity on them. I don't know where we've ever forced Christianity on anybody, but this is the typical argument. Now, in their book, Godless Constitution, to kind of give you a flair for what they teach, on page 143, they say the framers erected a godless federal constitutional structure, which was then undermined as God entered first the U.S. currency in 1863, then the Federal Mail Service in 1912, and finally the Pledge of Allegiance in 1954. Now, first of all, they're sure putting a whole lot of weight on the currency, saying in God we trust early on, or having God on it somewhere, then the Federal Mail Service, and of course the Pledge of Allegiance. I mean, to me, it's silly, but this is the kind of argument that you'll hear. On page 153, they say the founders of this nation would regard the mixing of religion and politics in the ways now being engineered by the religious right as part of the problem of failing public morality rather than as an answer. Now, first of all, I want you to notice the disconnect in the way they're talking. They don't want religion and politics combined, and they say because we're combining those, we're creating failing public morality. Does that even make sense? How do you have morality if you don't have religious standards? Now, we don't agree with them, but in the Middle East, there are many countries that use the Quran and you have Sharia law. Well, we don't agree with any of that, but at least they're using religious standards, albeit incorrect standards and brutal standards. But every culture has a set of moral standards. It's either some kind of pagan religion, or it's the Christian religion, or Judeo-Christianity. But the bottom line is we all have some standard of morality. If you don't, there's no such thing as morality. Then you go back to Judges, where every man does what is right in his own eyes. There is no standard. So actually, they're talking contradictory to what they're trying to say here on page 153. Now, at the end of their book, they say something that's kind of interesting. And they say that we have dispensed with the usual scholarly apparatus of footnotes for the book. Well, how convenient is that? I mean, it actually goes to the point I was making a while ago about going to original source documents to prove your point. These guys say, well, there's no need in doing that. In other words, don't check up on what we're saying because we can't prove anything. This is just our opinion. That was printed. That's in the book. Now, here's the thing about this. If they want to write a book about their opinions in a free country with First Amendment expression rights, they can. At least they were honest and said, we can't back up any of this. Now, they weren't really saying any of this, because probably some of it they could. But my point is, they're admitting that they really can't back this up with original source documents, claiming that the framers wanted to create a godless federal structure. Now, it just so happens I can back up the opposite claim. For instance, here's John Adams. In a letter to Thomas Jefferson, June the 28th, 1813, he says this: the general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. Now, one of the reasons why we don't put these whole quotes is many times the quote would be so long. We're not trying to hide anything here by condensing these quotes. I will avow that I then believed and now believe that those general principles of Christianity are as eternal and immutable as the existence and attributes of God, and that those principles of liberty are as unalterable as human nature. Well, now there happens to be some documented information. Well, let's don't just stop there. Let's consider this. Many of you are very familiar with this painting. No photographs, no cameras, so all we are left with is eyewitness testimony, and many times the eyewitness testimony was taken by artists, and they would try to recreate certain scenes. And many of you over the years have probably heard Paul talk about this event. It happened on September the 7th, 1774. It's loosely called the first prayer in Congress. It happened in Carpenter's Hall in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Now, if you're not familiar with the background, just let me very quickly set it up for you. When the Continental Congress started to meet together, one of the first things that was suggested is that we ought to pray. We ought to ask God's blessings on our proceedings. Well, different denominations were there, and in those days, the denominations did not mix very well, which is very different from today, right? We don't mix all that well today either. And so a number of different men stood up and objected, saying, well, I don't know how we can all have a prayer service here when some of us are Anglican, some of us are Episcopalian, some of us are Presbyterian. I'm paraphrasing. Some of us are Baptist. And finally, Samuel Adams stands up and he says, look, I can pray with any man of piety who simply loves his country. And that kind of settled the debate. Everybody said, okay. So they called a local preacher who happened to be an Anglican preacher. His name was Jacob Duché. And they had him scheduled to come on September the 7th to read a passage of Scripture and then lead them in some type of prayer. And you have to remember the Anglicans, that's the Church of England, by the way, in now America, very strict about how they pray. Most of their prayers are written down. Now, we sometimes are critical of that. There's nothing wrong with a prayer being written down. You don't have to pray an extemporaneous prayer for it to be sincere. So many times they would write their prayers down, and they had prayer books, and they would read these prayers. As long as it's sincere, a written and read prayer is just as powerful as one just right off the heart. Now, it can become just liturgy and meaningless, which I think in many denominations today it is. So anyway, he's an Anglican preacher. So he comes down and he's going to lead in this prayer service. But no one knew what it was going to be. And I'll prove it to you in just a moment by a letter that John Adams writes to Abigail on September the 16th. So about 9 days later, he writes Abigail. And so they didn't know what to expect. Now, in this picture, of course, are many of our framers. I don't call them founders simply for my own benefit. Founders are from the Pilgrims up to this generation. I call these the framers. For instance, notice right there, standing beside each other, that's Samuel Adams and John Adams. They're cousins, so they're fairly noted. Here's the great Christian Patrick Henry on his knees in prayer. There's George Washington. Of course, there's Jacob Duchesne, the Anglican preacher. And over here is John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States of America before they ruled America. So noted individuals are at this prayer meeting, as, of course, you would imagine. Now, the effect of this moment, though, we would be left to speculation. Were it not for the fact that some of the delegates wrote about it. And one of them of note, of course, is John Adams. And John writes to Abigail on the 16th of September, so a little over a week later. And he says, the next morning, this is in his narrative, which would have been September the 7th, the actual day of Carpenter's Hall meeting. He, that's Jacob Duchesne, the pastor, appeared and read several prayers. So he's reading out of the Anglican prayer book. And then read the collect for the seventh day of September, which happened to be the 35th Psalm. So this would have been their equivalent to a daily devotional. So in a daily devotional, you have a prayer and you have a passage of scripture that you're to read. Now, if you're familiar at all with the 35th Psalm, it talks about establishing a nation under God. Now, how coincidental was it that that was the passage of scripture in the Anglican prayer book is set up for the 7th of September, 1774, and Duchesne is there to meet with the Continental Congress, and he reads the 35th Psalm. So if you haven't read it in a while, go back and read it. And when you do, you'll say, egads, there couldn't have been a better passage of Scripture if he had chosen it himself. But it had been chosen long before anybody knew that he was going to be reading this in Carpenter's Hall. Now, Adam goes on to say, you must remember this was the next morning after we heard the horrible rumor of the cannonade of Boston. I never saw a greater effect upon an audience. It seemed as if heaven had ordained that psalm to be read on that morning. So see, I'm not just speculating. John Adams said it. After this, Mr. Duchesne, unexpected to everybody, see how nobody knew exactly what was going to happen? Struck out into an extemporary prayer. Now, Adams says that because that was not the tradition of Anglican preachers, and of course many others the same way. So he said, after he read the 35th Psalm, he just broke out into a prayer. Now, I think you can read between the lines here, something's happening. There's something spiritual going on here that maybe even Duchesne didn't expect. Which filled the bosom of every man present. Have you ever been in a situation, in a prayer meeting like that, where it just kind of fills you up? I must confess, I never heard a better prayer or one so well pronounced in language so elegant and sublime for America, for the Congress, for the province of Massachusetts Bay, and especially the town of Boston. Of course, we're very concerned about Boston because the British had occupied it, and that was the key source of commerce and everything else. And they knew that if Boston remained in British hands and ultimately was just dominated by the British, it could destroy everything. Now notice what Adams finishes. He says, it has had an excellent effect upon everybody here. And then he says to Abigail in a personal note, I must beg you to read that psalm. So something special happened here. Now does that sound like a bunch of godless individuals? No, but Isaac Moore Isaac Cramnett and Lawrence Moore says they intended to do everything in a godless fashion. Really? Really? No, of course not. And then, of course, you know that eventually the Continental Congress churns out this document. This document, which actually they believe, many of them believed, was their death warrant. And I can't remember where it is in this presentation. It's not, because it's in the declaration. But even a Presbyterian preacher by the name of John Witherspoon, who was also the president of what is now Princeton, actually gets up and gives a speech when everybody's kind of wavering. And if you want me to, of course, I'm trying to build these other two up, so you want me to teach those as well. But if you want me to teach those, if you just twist my arm, I'll teach those as well. And we'll hear his speech. Okay, the point is, it produces this document. They all thought they were signing their death warrant. So when people like Benjamin Franklin say, if we don't hang together, we'll hang separately, he was making light of it, but he was serious. These guys were convinced they were going to die. If you've read my book on the Black Robe Regiment, there's a section in there where I have some of the little excerpts from letters of Black Robe preachers that were actually out in the field fighting for liberty, writing their families. And they're all admitting that if they lose this effort, they'll be hanged. I mean, they knew it. So they understood. In fact, some of the men standing in line to sign, and by the way, they didn't all sign the declaration that day. In fact, they were in and out of Philadelphia all summer signing the declaration. But while they were standing in line, one particular gentleman was standing beside Elbridge Gerry, who was one of the delegates there. And Gerry was a very kind of skinny, shorter individual. The other fella was big and robust, and he was making light, and he said, you know, if we're hanged for this, I'll have a much greater advantage than you. And Gerry said, what do you mean? He said, well, I'm big enough that when they hang me, it'll crack my neck just like that, but you're so scrawny that it won't break your neck, and you'll strangle as you hang there for a handful of minutes. Now, he's saying that to try to kind of break the tension. I don't know if that helped. But that actually, I mean, that's the kind of, you know, trepidation that they had. You got to remember, they're about to declare their independence from the strongest empire in the world at that time. And they knew the wrath of the Redcoats could drop on them like a ton of bricks. They knew it. They didn't want it, but they knew it. And so they, with great fear, signed that document. Now, here's another. He's not the only guy I quote from in this presentation. Don't think it's just a John Adams presentation. But these are really great quotes. Now, this is a letter to Pastor Zabdiel Adams. So don't confuse him with John Adams. This is a pastor named Zabdiel Adams. He wrote June the 21st. And the reason why I chose this letter is note when it's written. It's written June the 21st, 1776. So they haven't actually voted to declare their independence yet, and they are not signing the declaration yet. They're in the process. So he's filled, I'm sure, individually, with great anxiousness, anxiety. He says, statesmen, my dear sir, may plan and speculate for liberty, but it is religion and morality alone which can establish the principles upon which freedom can securely stand. The only foundation of a free constitution is pure virtue. And if this cannot be inspired into our people in a greater measure than they have it now, they may change their rulers and the forms of government, but they will not obtain a lasting liberty. Boy, that last part is a message to us. But if you want to fill in the blanks, he says, it's religion and morality alone which establish the principles upon which freedom can securely stand. They understood this. So does that sound like a godless individual? No, of course not. And Adams is simply representative of a good number of the people there. Now, let me also say, I'm not sure how many of the framers were what we would call born-again Christians. I hope that many of them, in fact, I hope they all were. Chances are they all weren't. But they did live in a time when the American church was doing its job. And so the church had tremendous influence in the culture. And most of these men had a profound respect for the God of the Bible and the Bible. And they admit it in many different ways. Now, Adams was Episcopalian, I believe, and got involved in the Unitarian movement later in his life. But the Unitarian movement then is not what the Unitarian movement is today. The Unitarian movement today says anything goes. That's what the Unitarian movement is where everybody's right. Buddhists are right. Muslims are right. Christians are right. Atheists are right. Well, how could that be right? I mean, everybody can't be right, right? I'm trying to get you to laugh. Come on, loosen up. Well, anyway, But Unitarians, the Unitarian movement began in Boston, just so you'll know. In fact, if you go to Boston, a lot of the old churches that have been around for a couple of centuries or longer are all, most of them say Unitarian, even though it may be Presbyterian or whatever, say Unitarian. But the Unitarian movement, though it was wrong, you know what they believed? They were arguing about the Trinity. They rejected the doctrine of the Trinity. That was what a Unitarian was then. So if you ever hear somebody say, well, Adams wasn't even a Christian, he's a Unitarian, you have to understand the history context or the historical context. Unitarians in John Adams' day were not Unitarians of our day. See, that's important because that's the kind of tricks that are played on us if we don't know. Now, was Adams a born-again Christian? Well, I think he claimed to be. I hope he was. I hope he's not in hell. But notice he understood exactly what it takes for self-governance. Now, of course, what they dreaded the most, and I don't mean to keep hawking my book, but in my book, I have quote after quote, and in these other two presentations of the Declaration, I'll share some of them with you. I have quote after quote after quote after quote of preachers who are saying, we did not want this separation. We didn't want war. We wanted to stay with the mother country. They considered themselves Englishmen. So understand all that. That's why Paul Revere was not writing, yelling, the British are coming. That'd be like us if we saw an army convoy coming down I-35 running here saying, the Americans are coming. We would say the military or the army is coming, right? He was saying the regulars are coming because he was an Englishman. So he wouldn't have been saying the British are coming. So they didn't want to separate. But we all know our history well enough to know this is a painting of the battle at Lexington. It starts in 75. Of course, that's still a year. April the 19th, 75, that's still a year before the Declaration, which tells you how much patience the colonies were showing toward the king, that they'd already had battles. Because that afternoon, they're going to fight at Concord. So they've already had battles, and then just a few weeks later in June, early June, they're going to have what we call the Battle of Bunker Hill. Over 800 redcoats are killed in that battle. That's a major battle. And still, we're a year off from the Declaration of Independence, which again shows you what I believe is in their favor, great patience. Well, as you know, we end up winning the war. Nobody could have imagined that, I think, including the framers, and we win. There's the Trumbull painting of the surrender of Cornwallis. That's really not Cornwallis. That's his subordinate. And so that's why George Washington said, well, if you're going to send your subordinate, I'm going to send my subordinate. So Washington's back over here. He's not accepting the surrender. Mr. Lincoln, Mr. Lincoln is accepting the surrender of Cornwallis's subordinate because Cornwallis is hiding in shame and won't even show up. And of course, right over here, right there, that's Peter Muhlenberg. And of course, this painting hangs in the Capitol Rotunda in D.C. So you have the quintessential Black Robe Regiment preacher, Peter Muhlenberg, right there, and you have the surrender. Now, our actual, well, people get hung up on firsts and all this, but from my perspective, our really first or original Constitution was the Articles of Confederation. This is the, if you want to call it Constitution, that the colonies were functioning under. And the Articles created the Union, but states were in charge of their destiny. You did not have this central government that controlled what states did then, and of course, what states do now. We're almost completely under the control of the central government. But the Articles of Confederation did not clamp down on the states enough, unfortunately. So after the war, America owes a lot of war debt. And to their shame, the states started reneging on their commitment to help pay it off. In fact, even some of the states that had been colonies before the war, some of these states were passing legislation not to pay the debts. Well, who's going to pay the debt? Thank you, Miss Lucy. So who's going to pay the debt? Well, somebody's going to have to force them to, or America's going to default. You got to remember, it's a fledgling union. In fact, they're really concerned that if the states, previous colonies begin to break away, Britain will just come back over and defeat them one at a time. By the way, if you think that was an unrealistic fear, think of the War of 1812. Okay, so the British wanted to come right back. They were smarting over their loss, but they just couldn't believe they had lost. They said, if we can have one more shot at them, we'll defeat them. And by the way, the War of 1812, they almost did. So anyway, because the states are reneging, they called for a constitutional convention. The first one was planned for Baltimore, and not enough people would respond to it, so they postponed it. But finally, another one was called, and on May the 25th, 1787, they gathered together. And it lasted until the fall, September 17th, 1787. They met at the Philadelphia State House. 70 delegates are picked for this constitutional convention. Now, it wasn't initially, at least publicly, supposed to be a constitutional convention. What had most of the states sent their delegates to do? Does anybody know? Strengthen the Articles of Confederation. That were their marching orders. And many actually argue that the delegates went beyond their commissions from their states. And so that's a big debate in these days. But you have, let's get to this, and then we'll stop here. You've got 70 delegates, and in just a little bit, well, it's going to be next week, we'll talk about how those delegates show up and who out of the 70. But they begin on May the 25th, and of course, the first thing they do is they elect George Washington as the president, not of the country. There is no country yet, really. I mean, the Articles of Confederation, but everything's coming apart. They elect him as president of the convention, and they establish the rules. Now, I want to stop right here, but this was a mistake. They voted to keep all the proceedings completely secret and shut out the press. That was a mistake. That was a huge mistake that should have never been made. So let's stop right there. That's a pretty good cliffhanger. I didn't plan it that way, but that worked out great. So let's stop right there, and we'll pick up next week. Is this okay? I mean, do you feel like this is not a Bible study? Because we'll get to more Christianity in this deal. Okay, well, then we'll work on this next week. So hopefully this gives you something to look forward to, okay? All right. All right, we'll start right there with number 4 on your outline. Next, not number 4 on your outline, number 4 on this. All right, you're dismissed. We'll have service here in a bit.